The question was never whether Nathaniel Hawthorne could write. The question was whether he'd ever be able to make a living doing it.
He was using what we call the buckshot approach to publishing.
That's Rosemary Fiske. She's an English professor at Samford University and the former president of the Hawthorne Society.
He was just sending out everything anywhere he thought someone would take it, and he was often left waiting for his royalty check.
Hawthorne's stories were well regarded among circles of serious writers and readers. The problem was, those circles were relatively small.
His twice-told tales had just sold a few hundred copies.
To stay afloat while he wrote, Hawthorne had worked as an editor in local government. Heck, he even tried his hand at transcendental communal living. But by 1849, the hand-to-mouth existence was wearing him thin.
Hawthorne had lost his job at the Salem Custom House. He was now married, had two children. They'd had multiple housing moves. His mother had just died, and he had passed his 45th birthday. So I thought he was at the average age for going postal.
Enter James Thomas Fields, a whip-smart, self-made man who'd worked his way up from bookstore employee to junior partner of the Boston publishing house Tickner and Fields. He was well-connected and had a singular knack for knowing exactly what the public wanted.
He was the extrovert to Hawthorne's introverted side, and I think that when they finally linked together, it was a real moment in American literary history.
That moment came during that fateful year of 1849.
Fields tells the story of finding Hawthorne in this rental house there in Salem, hovering near a stove, and Hawthorne saying, "Who would risk publishing a book for me, the most unpopular writer in America?"
Given its dramatic flourishes, Fiske suspects that that story is a bit of myth-building on Fields' part. But
it still has a truth to it, that Fields did intervene sometime late in 1849 and say, "I'll publish your book, but here's what needs to happen first."
The book was a collection of literary sketches, with a romance set in Puritan Boston as its centerpiece, the tale of an affair, and the toll that it took on the close-knit community, and the story's protagonist, Hester Prynne.
On January 15, 1850, when he wrote to Fields, "I shall call the book Old-Time Legends, together with sketches, experimental and ideal." Fields had to know, no, that's not going to work.
Fields convinced Hawthorne to drop the other stories and focus exclusively on what is known today as the Scarlet Letter. Rosemary Fiske is among the scholars who also believe that Fields played a central role in guiding Hawthorne as he expanded the work to novel length.
Fields suggested the final three chapters of the book, to say, go ahead and elaborate it.
While some question just how much influence Fields had over the text, no one disputes that upon publication in March of 1850, The Scarlet Letter was a smash hit, and Hawthorne was finally a professional writer.
From now on, Hawthorne would be able to stay at home and write and have some hope of supporting his family out of chronic poverty.
As for The Scarlet Letter, it would stand the test of time. Considered today not just Hawthorne's magnum opus, but also an indispensable part of the American literary canon, much to the dismay of generations of high school students.
We wish every high school student who complains about having to read the book now could be committed to read it again at age 30 or age 50, and I think they would get the real haunting emotional power of it.
The Scarlet Letter, first published to great success, thanks to Nathaniel Hawthorne's pen and James T. Fields' business acumen, right here in Massachusetts, 165 years ago this week. From the Curiosity Desk, I'm Edgar B. Herlick III, WGBH, Boston's local NPR.